Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director of the Lowy Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this panel event on the future of the rules-based order in Asia and the Pacific. This is the kickoff, actually, for a joint dialogue between Britain and Australia, known as the Australia-UK-Asia Dialogue. And I'd like to welcome some of the dialogue participants who are with us today, as well as a number of young scholars and professionals. And in particular, I'd like to welcome my co-chair, Sir John Holmes of the Ditchley Foundation. I'm going to chair this first part of today's discussion. I'm going to have a conversation with my colleagues on the panel, and then Sir John will come up after a tea break to involve everybody else in the room in the discussion. This initiative, this high-level dialogue, began in 2014, and it was an idea of the then Foreign Secretary William Hague and the Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, who wanted to reinvigorate the bilateral relationship and focus it on Asia, given that both Australia and Britain have long-term historical and economic and security interests in this part of the world. It's a good time to host this fourth iteration of the dialogue. Of course, last Thursday, the Australian government launched its new foreign policy white paper, in which I think Justin was very involved. I went down for the launch in Canberra of the white paper, and then on the Friday, I participated in a high-level dialogue between Australia and China, where a number of the Chinese delegations asked very searching questions of us about the contents of the foreign policy white paper. So the timing is good. We've also had some very lovely news overnight. So in the presence of the British High Commissioner, let me congratulate Prince Harry and Meghan Markle on their engagement. Long may the royal family reign over Britain. I do hope that that nice news from Buckingham Palace somewhat compensates for the other news out of Brisbane this week. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce our panellists. On the far left of the panel, we have Justin Hayhurst, who's First Assistant Secretary in the Foreign Policy White Paper Task Force in DFAT. He was previously Head of Mission at Australia's Beijing Embassy, so has probably been on the receiving end of some of lectures similar to the ones that I received in Melbourne last Friday. Next to Justin, we have Professor Hugh White. Hugh has had a long and distinguished career as a journalist, a public servant, a political staffer, a think tanker, and an academic. He's a professor at the Australian National University. He's one of Australia's best and most influential strategic thinkers, and he's the author of a new quarterly essay titled Without America, Australia in the New Asia. To Hugh's right, we have Her Excellency Menna Rawlings, who's the British High Commissioner to Australia and the official recipient of all Ashes gags. Menna is a wonderful advocate.
Early days.
Yeah, early days, true. A wonderful advocate of Britain's interests in Australia, but she's also a great friend of the Lowy Institute. Thank you for joining us, Menna, and thank you to you and your colleagues for your partnership on this dialogue in this event. And finally, Professor Rosemary Foote, who is Senior Research Fellow at Oxford's Department of Politics and International Relations. Rosemary has held posts at the People's University in Beijing, at Princeton, Harvard, and Fudan University in Shanghai. She also taught me a course called the International Relations of East Asia when I was a graduate student at Oxford. But no doubt Oxford will now be following the Australian government's new style guide, and that course will be called the International Relations of the Indo-Pacific. Yes,
right,
good.
Yes.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming this panel. Rosemary, perhaps I can start with you. As an observer of British foreign policy, as a Brit, let me ask you perhaps to begin, how do you think British foreign policy is developing in the post-Brexit era? We heard a lot during the Brexit campaign about how Brexit would produce a new global Britain, and it would represent a re-entry into the world. So do you think in the next 5 or 10 years, are we likely to see this kind of global Britain, or will we see something different? How big a distraction do you think the Brexit negotiations will be to the traditional British role in the world?
Yeah, I think, personally, I think it's a tremendous distraction. And I fear a decline in British influence in world politics. Of course, we will retain our UN role, and we will attempt to negotiate new trading relationships around the world. But it's very difficult to find many among the elite in regions, in various of the geographical regions of the world, that actually believe that this is going to be beneficial for UK influence. Being part of the European Union, I believe, was a very important move that helped to retain this more prominent role in world politics and helped to reinforce the idea of UN Security Council membership and the like. So I have genuine fears about a slow decline in British influence in the world. And I look at this in relation to the Asia Pacific and in relation to China as well. I mean, China cannot understand why we would take a decision of that kind and would build it into a broader narrative about the decline of the West and plebiscites of this kind resulting in unpredictable and unhappy outcomes.
Democracy is messy.
Yes, democracy is messy. And this is a very, you know, prime example of this. So I feel very extraordinarily gloomy about this. And that may, obviously, it's partly I teach international relations. I'm part of a university system that values all of these international connections. And I'm very concerned about what it will do in terms of application rates, in terms of our ability to attract top scholars and the like. So this sense of Britain being in decline and also being less open in some ways is something that bothers me greatly.
Mena, let me give you a right of reply, first of all. And also let me ask you to address the theme of this discussion is the rules-based order in Asia. It was obviously an important theme of the foreign policy white paper. So perhaps you can tell us a bit about how London regards the rules-based order, both globally and in Asia, and in particular, what kind of role do you think the UK can play in supporting that order in our part of the world?
Sure. Well, let me sort of perhaps deal with the first question, if I may, and in response to Rosemary, as you might not be surprised to hear, I don't agree. And I think part of the rationale, part of the thinking behind the vote itself was to want to see Britain more engaged on the international stage and leaning into a wider set of relationships around the world than the European Union. And I think if you look at the international bodies that we're members of, we're still going to be members of the G7, the G20, a P5 member of the Security Council, the Commonwealth, NATO, etc. One of the few countries that spends 2% of GDP on defence and 0.7% of gross national income on development aid. None of that is changing. I think, you know, clearly the period we're going through at the moment where we're deep in the negotiation, I completely understand the desire to see progress on that. But even while we're negotiating, you're still seeing the British government very engaged in the world. This week we've got Dr. Liam Fox, who's our Secretary of State for International Trade, here in town, in fact, really sort of trying to build a new set of relationships on trade, including with Australia. Yesterday, for example, it's just one small example, but we've announced that there's going to be a Royal Naval ship down in these waters early next year. So, you know, I think if you listen to people like Liam, as I have done a lot in the last 24 hours, this sense of optimism, of openness, of engagement is still a really, really strong factor in our foreign policy. And although I understand the concerns and, you know, we listen to them and respect them, I'm not as worried as Rosemary is about Britain's long-term place in the world. I think in terms of your second question, or leading into the rules-based international system, what does that mean? I mean, I think we would absolutely support everything in the excellent foreign policy white paper, which talks about the importance of the rules-based system as really mattering given some of the complexities and the challenges of the world that we live in. I think for two reasons. One, values. I also really like the values piece in the Australian white paper, which I think, you know, absolutely speaks to the values that we see as underpinning that rules-based international system, but also in terms of protecting and promoting shared interests in the Indo-Pacific, as in other parts of the world. And I'm sure we'll expand on that as we go through the rest of the panel.
Thank you. Justin, perhaps I can invite you to join the conversation. Tell us a bit about why did the government put this idea of a rules-based order front and centre, and why should we have confidence, do you think, that that a country like Australia that's endured so much political trouble in the last decade has the wherewithal and the spine to really make a difference in supporting it when it's under such pressure?
Well, I think this government's been very consistent in its emphasis on rules when it talks about foreign policy. And the white paper has a number of sort of strong themes, like economic openness, for example, an emphasis on the way that values and interests align in Australian foreign policy, and the importance of a rules-based order for our interests. The white paper sets out very clearly that the world that Australia has known is changing in unprecedented ways. And it's clear that this has an impact across many issues, including on international and regional rules and institutions. The white paper also says that power is a big thing in international relations, and that as there are shifts in power internationally, the rules become more important to Australia. Now, Australia, of course, has a degree of international influence. The white paper's message is we have to maximise it and use it and act with our partners to try and shape the environment we're in. So in response to these challenges, the Australian government's view is that we can't be passive, we can't be fatalistic, we have to be active, and we have to be clear-eyed about where we need to go, knowing that we're dealing with very complex issues and that the changes we face are multifaceted, various, and in some cases pretty fast-moving.
And what about the second question? That is, I mean, I know you're an official, but it's often said that foreign policy begins at home, for example, and often you see when leaders or governments have been in place for some time, they have the relationships, they have the confidence to really make a difference in the world. That hasn't been the pattern of Australian politics over the past decade. What do you think about our capacity to really influence this fast-changing world when so many of our leaders are focused inward and really struggling to survive from poll to poll, from election to election?
Look, like all countries, Australian leaders focus predominantly on domestic issues. The government, if you read the media coverage, is under pressure from within and without and all the rest of it. I'm an official, I can't comment on that, but what I can say is that right at this moment, when issues are very difficult internationally, the Australian government's decided to look at the fundamentals of its policy, to have a debate with the Australian public, to open a public consultation process where we had more than 9,000 public submissions, to have the minister, the two main ministers, Julie Bishop and Stephen Chobo, engage extensively with different stakeholder groups to debate these issues at high level and in a serious way in cabinet, and then to put out, and it's not an easy thing to do, put out a thoughtful, considered document about how the government sees the world changing and what it proposes to do about it. Now, people will have a debate about that, and that debate is actually taking place right now, and it's a very healthy and a very good thing. The white paper does recognise that what happens within Australia is critical to our international influence. The first chapter of the paper is actually about largely about domestic policy, the strength and vitality of our economy, the cohesion of Australian society. The reason those things are in there, and this doesn't go to the day-to-day vagaries of politics, is because we've had to think about, in a highly globalised and interconnected world, what sort of countries do well? And the Australian government's answer are countries that are open to talent, to ideas, to trade and investment, and that have dynamic economies and can retain a degree of social cohesion. So I think the ingredients are there. The white paper sets out the issues. There's an agenda there to be implemented, and we'll see over the next few years how that goes. But I think if you move away from the vagaries of day-to-day politics and focus on economic and social fundamentals, Australia does have some of the critical things it's going to need in a fast-changing world. And that's the government's view, and I think it's clearly stated in the document.
Hugh, let me bring you in. I want to come back and ask you about the rules-based order, but first of all, let me ask you about, put the same question to you that I just put to Justin. You're somebody who's served in government under governments of both persuasions, someone who's worked as a staffer. What are your observations about how the difficulties in Australian politics over the past 10 years or so have influenced our foreign policy debate, our ability to see the world clearly, but then having diagnosed it, our politicians' willingness to take risks to implement their policies?
Look, it's a really good question, and a fair answer has to acknowledge that the challenges that our governments, on governments of both sides of politics, over the last few years and today face are more demanding than those that were faced by the governments, for example, the government I served in in the 80s and 90s. And that's because it's become clear in about the last decade that Australia is facing the most fundamental transformation in its international circumstances since 1788, with the decline of the rules-based order, by which, at least in the Australian debate, we mean American primacy in Asia. That's what that phrase means. And the government is right to think that it's under pressure. I think, personally, it underestimates how big that pressure is. Now, that's a really big challenge. For the first time since European settlement, we have to think about how Australia makes its way in an Asia which is not dominated by, if I can use that old-fashioned expression, an Anglo-Saxon great and powerful friend. And we don't have any national model for how we do that. And indeed, we have less idea today than we would have had even in the 70s and 80s, because at least in the 70s and 80s, having come out of the Vietnam experience and the failure of forward defence and all of that, we had a stronger national debate about the nature of our relationship with Asia. But what happened after the Cold War, as we all read, if I may put it this way, too much Francis Fukuyama, and became too convinced that we were heading into an era in which the United States' primacy globally in Asia was going to be unchallengeable, we stopped asking questions, which in some ways we started asking as early as the late 19th century, about what we would do when the Anglo-Saxon great and powerful French left. And so Australian politicians, and I might say Australian policy intellectuals, not just the ones working as politicians, but the ones who are working as public servants or the ones who are working in the sorts of fields that we do, are facing a new intellectual challenge. And so it's really hard. Now, add to that, we are going through a period, whether it's bad luck or something systemic, we don't know, we're going through a period of unusually weak political leadership in Australia. And you can just look at the numbers from even leaving world off to one side. From 1975 to 2007, we had four prime ministers, all of whom, you could disagree with things that all of them did, but all of them whom were broadly quite good at the job. And since then, we've had four prime ministers, none of whom have really looked like they were doing the job capably. And it's been, it will be anyway very hard for an Australian political leader to stand up and say, we have to fundamentally rethink our place in Asia. But it's been much harder for that series of politicians, being as they are in very weak political circumstances, to have the courage to stand up and say, we need to rethink what we do. So they cling to the old formulae, and the world, the environment gets tougher and tougher, and so it becomes harder and harder to start talking sensibly about these things, and so the political challenge gets greater, and I think that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Let me ask you another question about the rules-based order. You identified that only with American primacy, and I think some people might challenge you on that. I don't remember George W. Bush, for example, being particularly enthusiastic about the rules-based order when he ordered an invasion of Iraq without the support of the UN Security Council, for example. But let me ask you, how do you feel about the prominence that was given to the rules-based order in the foreign policy white paper? And if you think, as I suspect you might, that it was misplaced, why would it not be in Australia's interest to try to support the rules-based order? Given that, as you always acknowledge, we've been a huge beneficiary of the rules-based order, given that the future is contingent and none of us really knows where China will be in 20 years, or indeed where the United States will be. Why wouldn't a country of Australia's size that benefits from that a world in which states, especially big states, play according to the rules, why wouldn't we do absolutely everything we can to buttress that order?
Okay, very good question. Let's start with being careful about our articles. There is no such thing as the rules-based order. There are different sets of rules enforced and upheld by different players. I'm pretty sure we're going to live in a rules-based order in Asia. I'm very unsure that the rules are going to be set by the United States or enforced by the United States. That's not something I want. If I had my way, I would live under American uncontested primacy forever. It's been superb for Australia and superb for Asia. And of course, if we had our druthers, of course that's what we'd want. And if there was a serious option of struggling to support it, then that's what we should do. And that is what the white paper, I would say, argues for. My only reservation about it is I don't think it's going to work. And I think the problem for us is that by clinging to something that's got a very low chance of working, we're going to preclude ourselves from doing things which will work more effectively to adapt to the actual circumstances we're more likely to face. So don't get me wrong. I love the old rules based order, the US led rules based order. For all the fact that sometimes America broke the rules itself, I was never, as you know, a fan for the invasion of Iraq. But the way that phrase is now being used, the way it's used in the white paper, for example, and remember, it's quite an innovation in Australian foreign policy rhetoric. At least the reification of it that we see in the white paper and that we've seen in speeches over the last 3 or 4 years. It's an innovation, and I think the historians will very plainly judge that the Australian government started using it as code for preserving US primacy. That's why I make that identification.
Rosemary, what do you think? I mean, you're a long-term watcher of China in particular and Asia. What do you think about Australia's decision to, as Hugh says, to reify the rules-based order? Is this a rational approach, or do you think we should be moving in a different direction?
I think we have to, we have to be very self-questioning about this. I mean, I think we have to step back and say, what exactly do we mean by the rules-based order, and do we all in the Indo-Pacific agree on what those rules are and what those dominant rules are? Mm-hmm. And if it becomes interpreted as an order that is essentially trying in some ways to exclude China and to represent a new form, if you like, a legal form of containment of China, then I don't think you're going to get very far in the region itself. Because I think you will see interpretations in the region of the rules that don't necessarily agree with your interpretation or with the American interpretation and the like. So I think one of the most important things to do is to step back and say, what do we mean? Which rules do we think are under most threat? Where can we make a difference? How can we actually find a basis for consensus on the interpretation of these rules? So something like freedom of navigation, for example. There isn't one interpretation of what that allows you to do in the region. Mm. And if we act as though those things are clear and are not subject to different interpretation, amongst a grouping of states that in some senses obviously contest the vision that Hugh is putting forward, that contest the notion that if it's not an American-based order, it must be a Chinese-based order. In fact, I think you would find that the variety of views, the different stances that countries take on economics and security are important to uncover, because they help to reinforce this sense that this is not China's region alone, that this is actually a contested space, but that we can find areas of consensus perhaps in interpreting the so-called rules.
So we have to avoid the intellectual trap of shrinking Asia to the dimensions of China in a way.
Yes, yeah. That's what I would argue, that there are other important groupings and other important states, obviously Japan, India, South Korea, the ASEAN countries and the like, that have one of their primary goals, and our goals, I think, should be to support them in this, is to retain as much policy autonomy as they possibly can. And in order, so this sort of mantra that we've had of not wanting to choose between the United States and China, if you pick that apart, what it really means is that we as individual states and particular groupings want to retain as much policy autonomy as we can. And we find various creative ways, not always successful ways, but sometimes a series of sort of incremental moves that allow us to keep that space in play. And I think that for me is the most important thing, and also important for the Australia and the UK to think about ways of maintaining that policy autonomy. And as I say, to repeat the point, that not all the rules-based order idea is just something that commands essential agreement across the region.
And it is one of the innovations I think you see in the region. You see more cooperation between middle powers or like-minded countries. You see different countries reaching out to each other and seeing how they can thicken their ties. Now, one of the perhaps the grouping that has attracted the most interest and the most controversy is the so-called Quad.
Yes.
The Quad grouping of the Americans and the Japanese and the Indians and the Australians. Now, as you know, it's had a varied history. It was there, then it was not there when Mr. Rudd's government decided to move away from the Quad, and we had the resuscitation of the Quad in recent times, albeit at an official's level. So you didn't have heads of government, you didn't have ministers there, but it's the beginnings of something. Do you think the Quad is? Would you characterize that as a creative attempt by other countries that to work with each other in order to retain policy autonomy, or do you see the Quad as more of an offensive organization that is, or grouping that is in some way a grouping of democracies that deliberately excludes China and perhaps in some way is trying to begin the sort of the spark of a containment strategy for China?
I mean, I think again, one would see different interests reflected in that Quad membership. For example, I don't think India is thinking about the Quad in order to contain China. I think it's much more to do with finding a strategic role, finding a way of linking, making sense, if you like, of the Indo-Pacific idea. I think in the case of Abe, it has been much more about, in the past anyway, it has, for Japan, it's been much more about underpinning this grouping with democratic values and the like. I mean, everyone has criticized the renewal of the concept on the grounds that it's not fleshed out at all. I mean, it's perceived on the US side, it's perceived perhaps in more military terms. Others within that grouping would think about the economic relationships that need to be deepened, the economic interdependence that needs to be developed. I mean, I would hope that the Quad actually would be open to additional states. Obviously, the importance of Indonesia can't be ignored. The importance of other of the ASEAN countries, of South Korea, for example. And therefore not reinforcing the sense of something exclusive based entirely on the idea of democratic values and nothing else, but actually based on a grouping of countries that want to provide some kind of order for the region, reinforcing the point I was making earlier, that this is a region where states do have particular ideas about the way in which it should be ordered. And the way in which overwhelming power by any one actor should be contested.
I want to bring Mena in about Britain's role in Asia, but before I do that, Mena, let me just ask the two Australians about the Quad, if I can. First of all, Justin, what was the Australian government's rationale in its involvement in reviving the Quad, and how does Canberra feel the first meeting went?
Well, I mean, Australia has very close and important relations with the United States, Japan, and India, obviously. And this is also set out in the white paper. You know, we have an agenda to deepen those relationships, but also to work across them, and where we have common interests to seek by extending our cooperation to achieve a balance in the region that is favourable, in Australia's case, to Australia's interests. I mean, four senior diplomats met to have a discussion on the margins of an international meeting, and from there, presumably other discussions will proceed. I suppose, wanted to say one thing. I mean, the idea that this is somehow about containing China doesn't make sense to me. The Prime Minister, when asked by the media after the launch of the White Paper about the idea that some of this was about containing China, was, I think, rightly and appropriately dismissive. I mean, no one's talking about containing China. It's not possible. And every single one of those countries is in the business of deepening, insofar as it can, ties and relations with China across a wide variety of interests, and that's what Australia is doing. We also have other things to talk about and other things to pursue with different partners, and it makes sense. Earlier this week, we also had a trilateral meeting between officials, between India, Australia and Indonesia. Again, there's a lot of common interests between those three countries that make sense to discuss and to look at what we can do together rather than separately or in a big multilateral organisation to sort of pursue those interests. I don't know what was on the agenda for that discussion, but I think the fact of it simply shows that Australia and these partners are interested in the shape of the regional order in the future and they want to do something about it. Where it goes in the future, I guess we'll see. But it's not about containing the uncontainable.
Hugh, what do you think about the Quad? Well, I don't know what it's for if it's not for containing China. And, of course, these are three countries with whom we have a great deal in common and very important bilateral relations. No reason not to get together. But I think it's hard to look at the timing and the context and the setting and the whole deal and not see the Quad as intended, particularly by its most passionate advocate at the moment, it's Abe, as intended as a response to China. And it is important to get out there that China does have a vision of the Asian order which is very different from the one that we have traditionally supported and still support. But Rosemary's right, just because the Chinese have that vision doesn't mean it's going to come about. But it means that if it's going to be stopped, it's going to require a very substantial effort. And the question then is the Quad the thing to do it? Or is it going to help doing it? I'd be more confident that it was if the Chinese were more worried about it. The fact that the Chinese said, sure, go ahead. Put it that way, I tend to share their judgment. I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that those four countries have a sufficient alignment of interests in supporting one another against China, that they're prepared to sacrifice their individual relationships with China significantly to support one another. Because each of those countries have relationships with China which are extremely important to them. And so will India sacrifice its interest in its relationship with China to support Japan over whatever happens next in the East China Sea? Will Japan sacrifice its interests in its relationship with China to support Australia and something we might disagree with the Chinese over? Will America sacrifice its relationships with China in order to support even the Japanese? Is it, to me, an open question with India, a very open question, I'd have said. And so if these countries are not in the end sufficiently resolved to cooperate together and sacrifice their relationships with China in order to support one another, it will fail to function, and if we're allergic to the word containment, I'll avoid it, it will fail to function as a mechanism to impede China's desire to achieve what China clearly wants, and that is to establish itself as the primary power in East Asia. As the Prime Minister acknowledged in his speech in Singapore on the 2nd of June this year, he did use that old speechwriter's ploy, we've all used it, some people suggest. But when he didn't offer any other suggestions, and when he didn't actually rebut that suggestion, we can say that he is dropping us a pretty broad hint that he too believes that, and what followed some people suggest, was a sentence that said, China seeks to establish a Monroe-style hegemony? Did he use hegemony? Anyway, some word like that. So it's very clearly on the Australian government's mind that that is what China is about doing. And we can be absolutely sure he won't respond to that effectively if we're not even prepared to admit to ourselves that that's what we think the Chinese are doing.
Mena, let me ask you about Britain's role in all this. Britain's not a member of the Quad. You're a European country. You're not a regional power. Some people would suggest, as the Prime Minister said, that therefore Britain, countries like Britain and France can't play a significant role in the region, can't help to support the international order. So tell us why those people who suggest that are wrong. How can Britain, which historically has played a crucial role in the global order, how can it play a role in the regional order?
I mean, there's a lot in that. I mean, I think, first of all, I mean, we're not a regional power, but we are a global power. And the region is part of the globe. So therefore, I think we do absolutely have a role to play in all of this. That's the first thing I'd say. I think I just want to sort of come back on a couple of points that have come up. And as I disagreed with Rosemary so much first time, I'd like to agree with a lot of what you said second time around. And I think the sort of points we would draw out is that this is not binary. I think some of the analysis of the white paper, not the white paper itself, to be fair, has been a lot about, you know, China versus the US and how does Australia, you know, maximize the economic opportunities, manage the security threats, cope with alleged US withdrawal from the region, etc. But I think it's a much more textured picture than that. And I think in the relationships that we have in the region, we really see that too. We've got Vicky Dredel here, who's joining us for the dialogue this week, who's our High Commissioner in Malaysia, for example. And I think, you know, the ASEAN countries and others, as Rosemary has said, have all got a part to play, and we take the relationships with those countries very seriously. I mean, I think the second thing is that when it comes to the rules-based international order, I recognise that there's not a sort of screed somewhere which says, you know, this is the rules-based international order. And in some areas, it's clearer than others. I think the FONOPS example is a good one of where it can be quite fuzzy and there's different interpretations. But in other areas, you know, we know when it's challenged when we see it. So we know that DPRK firing missiles over Japan and landing in Japan's EEZ, we know that's breaking the rules-based international order. When we see that in this region, as in elsewhere, we will use our place as a P5 member of the Security Council to try to be part of a global coalition which seeks to contain that threat. So I think we have a big role there. And then I think the third thing just to say is that sort of on the economic side, like others, we see immense opportunity in Asia. And I think two-thirds of global growth is going to happen in this continent, however we define it, by 2030. 90% of global growth in the next 10 years will be outside of the European Union. So, you know, obviously we are engaging in that and building those relationships in terms of trade, economic partnership in Australia and all around this part of the world. And last point very quickly is just one about geography. I think we sometimes forget that Beijing is closer to London than it is to Sydney. Pyongyang is closer to London than it is to Sydney. And Delhi is closer to London than it is to Perth. So this sort of sense that somehow for us Asia is over there, it doesn't really feel like that, I think, when you're sitting in the UK and you rather see it as part of your interconnected set of global relationships.
Personally, I'm delighted to hear that Pyongyang is closer to London than Sydney.
Does have a downside,
recently. We're running out of time, but I'm going to put two general questions to the panel and let panelists answer it as they wish, rather than directing these particular questions to particular panelists. First of all, let me ask about the effect of growing Chinese power on our internal affairs, because we know from history that the character of the international order from time to time is profoundly affected by the character of the leading power in that order. And for the last 75 years, the leading power in the global order has been a democracy, a country that's very much like ours, with which we share many values. And China is not that. It's an authoritarian country. It's led by a political party that I guess some would suggest is broadly Leninist in its approach to politics. We see a tightening of controls within China. And we also see influence operations by the Chinese government and by individuals and organizations that are linked to the party state. And we see that all over the world. We see it, there's reporting today from Canberra, but there's also reporting from Washington. It's increasingly a feature of the Chinese rise, that it's asking very tough questions of our institutions. So this is a bit of a reach from the rules-based order. I'm trying to bring it to some of the domestic issues. But let me invite any of the panelists who'd like to address it. As citizens of democracies, how do we respond? How should we respond to these challenges? How should we answer these questions? How can we build up our resilience? Rosemary?
If I could just begin by saying one of the things that we really need to start with is uncovering the narrative that China is developing about the decline of the West and the decline of our values mm-hmm. and our hypocrisy and our inability to solve various issues like refugee crises mm-hmm. and to live up to those sorts of values associated with forced migration and the like. So this first narrative is that liberal democracy really doesn't cut it any longer. And the Chinese would say that their version, the institutionalized consultative democracy, as they describe it, a top-down consultative mechanism, allows for more long-term thinking, allows for better outcomes, allows for bringing hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and all that. So there's a very powerful narrative that says that we, China, through our particular definition of democracy, create social unity, strength, prosperity for all, and support for the governing authorities, whereas you're all about, you know, disarray and diversity and all of those things. That narrative needs to be challenged strongly, because obviously we know that there's a huge amount of division inside China, that they spend more on internal security than they do on external security. You know, that they're extraordinarily worried about issues involving Xinjiang and Tibet and so on. So that sort of narrative really does need to be challenged. So does the narrative that they're developing on human rights. Again, they're arguing that we don't live up to our values, and there are certain areas where we mm-hmm. are certainly not living up to our values, and that includes in spades, I think, President Trump. But it's also the case that they are trying to shift the discussion of human rights away from the idea of the indivisibility and universality of human rights, and to argue instead that development, as they would put it, development solves all problems, and that once you get that kind of thing right, then all these other good things mm-hmm. will flow from that. So be aware of what the narrative is, if you mm-hmm. like, that the Chinese, and of course they're backing that up with their economic largesse and mm-hmm. the like, mm-hmm. and think about ways in which we should, A, live up to our own model, but also counter that particular, mm-hmm. particular narrative.
Would anybody else like to jump in on that? You?
Yes, look, first of all, to agree with a great deal of what Rosemary said. But I think the second thing, though, is, first of all, we need to take seriously, certainly from Australia's point of view, how big this challenge is. China is now in a position to be more influential over Australia than any country has ever been in our history, except for Britain and the United States. It's more important to us on more dimensions of our national life. And it has, partly just for economic reasons, a great capacity to impose costs on us when we do things it doesn't like. So we have to recognise the seriousness of the problem. The second thing we have to do is not panic. This is actually not that unusual in world history. Most countries, most of the time, live with very powerful countries in their sort of orbit, neighbours or otherwise, who can push them around. And the whole art of being a not very big power is to work out how to deal with that. We can do this. I don't think we should panic about it. And I have had a bit of a sense over the last few months in particular, slight sense of sort of moral panic setting in. It's like, keep calm. This is serious, but we can manage it. And the next thing is to recognise, just remember the way, most of the time, 95% of the time, the way great powers push smaller middle powers around is not actually by invading them. It's by imposing costs on them. Now, sovereign states have a huge capacity, even small and weak sovereign states have a huge capacity to dictate what happens on their territory. What great powers can do is not to tell you what you must do, it's just to impose costs on you if you do what they don't want. And it's then up to us to decide what costs we're willing to pay. So let's take an example that's not at random for someone who's in the university sector. The Chinese might well not like some of the things that are taught to Chinese students in Australia. We should resist any attempt from Beijing or elsewhere in China to dictate what we teach. The Chinese might well then decide to make us pay for that by taking some or all of their 160,000 students out of our tertiary education system. That will cost us a great deal. It'll either mean the collapse of our tertiary education system, a massive increase in fees, which would reduce equity, or a very big impost on consolidated revenue and therefore higher taxes. That is the choice we will face if China chooses to impose pressure on us that way. We can't stop China imposing pressure that way. We can decide how we respond to it. And across a very broad range of spectrum, those are the kinds of choices we are going to have to face as we deal with a country of a kind that we haven't dealt with before. Remember, this is the strongest, richest country in the world, and therefore, on the most significant dimensions, the strongest country in the world now, let alone when the chart on page 26, figure 2.4 of the white paper, if those predictions are realised and China's economy is $42 trillion to America's 24, 13 years from now. We have to recognise what a different kind of country China is, but we're going to have to deal with it in a way we haven't dealt with it with countries before, and just sort out the choices we're going to make. Don't panic, but recognise this is tough.
All right, let me ask the last question, and I'll invite everybody to.
I was going to come in on that if I could.
I don't think it's true to suggest, if that's what he was intending to suggest, that the Australian government is panicking about this.
No, I'm not suggesting the panic. No, that's
so you know.
I think out there.
I think. In government and in the white paper and in comments, the government is well apprised of the risks of foreign interference. There is also the risks that come through modern technology and new media applications that allow people outside to exert influence in a democracy. And Australia is determined to remain an open society. So whether it's in new cyber-enabled applications for critical infrastructure, whether it's on the internet, whether it's the integrity of our democratic processes or our institutions, the government has a very serious and considered response, and it's a challenge not unique to Australia or the United Kingdom, presumably, but we know about it in the United States and everywhere. There are people who seek to take advantage of openness to pursue their own agendas. Serious governments respond, and the Australian government has quite clearly has a very serious agenda in response, legislative and otherwise. So I just want to make that point pretty clear.
All right, last question, and I'll ask all the panellists to make a comment, but to please keep it concise because we're almost over time. I haven't mentioned Mr. Trump. That was quite deliberate because once you mention him, I find in these discussions, you never get off the topic. But I can't finish the panel without one question on Mr. Trump. How much harder does it make to defend and support and strengthen the rules-based order when you have a president of the United States who doesn't believe fundamentally that rules apply to him, whether it's in his personal behaviour or his political or his policy behaviour? When you have a leader of the free world who doesn't apparently believe in the free world, who's allergic or hostile to many of the institutions and the struts that have supported all of us for the last 75 years, whether it be free trade or alliances or relations with other democracies. How much of a challenge to the rules-based order is the President of the United States? Justin, why don't I start with you?
Look, the document that I've been working on for 12 months is a long-term framework. It's about the fundamental big issues. It's not about this administration. The current administration is not mentioned by name. It makes sense, of course, for the Australian government to have the strongest possible relationship with the Trump administration, and that's what we're doing. And I think it's working. And there are things that we are doing together that clearly advance the interests of both countries, whether it's in relation to North Korea or otherwise. But in the long term, and Hugh as a strategist and Rosemary as an academic looking at the long term, this is about well beyond a single administration. And there are some of us, and many of us in the Australian government, who believe there are fundamental strengths in the United States and fundamental interests that anchor its engagement in this part of the world, which means that a credible response to change in our regional strategic picture will inevitably involve the deep engagement of the United States. And our task is to maximize that relationship and to use it in a way that works for our interests. And I think, you know, it's very easy to get distracted by the day-to-day, but that's the long-term challenge.
All right, Hugh?
Yes.
I think, you know, very important point at the heart of Justin's response, that is, this is more than about Trump. I draw the opposite conclusion. Even without Donald Trump, America would face fundamental challenges to sustaining its position in Asia, and Australia would face fundamental challenges in depending on America to continue to deliver the order in Asia we want. I think the forces that are undermining American leadership go much, much deeper than Donald Trump. But the fact that the American voters, in their wisdom, have chosen to elect someone like Trump is a massive additional blow. It is true that relationships are bigger than personalities. But it's also true that personalities make governments. And Trump is the government, at least he's the executive government of the United States today. And he's very likely to be the executive government of the United States for another 3 years. He could easily be for another eight. And this does change things. And so I think it's a big mistake to see Trump as being the only problem. Big mistake not to see him as a massive amplification of the deeper problems that are there.
Anna?
I think I definitely agree with, as you'd probably expect, with everything Justin said about, you know, sort of playing the longer game. I think Hugh's point as well, in response to the earlier question, about we have to bear in mind the sort of longer-term perspectives on some of these challenges and some of the challenges we've dealt with in the UK over the years with a neighbour like Russia, or not an absolute neighbour, but not very far away neighbour, who has obviously at times challenged some of the same things in our society. So we're quite used to this. So I think, you know, first of all, when we look at the US, for us, it's our most important strategic alliance, just as it is Australia's. And we will do everything to maintain that and continue that. I think, second point, we should engage and influence like we do with every country around the world. That's our job. And as diplomats, you know, that's our agency. That's what we're here for. And that continues with this US administration, just as it has with any other. I know Australia is doing exactly the same thing. I think the other thing I'd say, and it's not really about Trump, I think it's a bit about the sort of fragmentation that we're seeing around the world and some of the challenges that we all face, is just leaning into more a wider set of international relationships. So in this region, for example, we've got the Five Powers Defence Agreement. We're going to talk about the Commonwealth, hopefully at some point, maybe in the next session. You know, we have all sorts of other conversations, networks, dialogues going on. Five Eyes, Four Eyes, Three Eyes. You have MICTA. You know, there's all sorts of different ways of developing, I think, a more variable and slightly more complex set of interconnected international relationships in order to manage some of those risks in perhaps, again, a less binary way than we've had to in previous years, I think, as the US is changing. I mean, all I would say, and I would never argue against Hugh on anything because he knows so much more than me about all of this, but I just note that I think it's easy to over-predict or over-anticipate the demise of US power in this region when you consider that something like, you know, 55%, I think, of US naval power is still in the Asia-Pacific and 65% of US combat power. So, you know, I'm sure there is a trend there which needs watching, but I don't think we should sort of predict absolute, you know, withdrawal or isolationism either.
Final word, Rosemary.
Okay. Well, all my fellow panelists have made some really good points, and I find myself agreeing with several of them. I mean, I suppose I would start from the argument, really, that we may recover a bit if it's a one-term presidency, but I do think that there is damage to the US role in the world and the perception of what the United States has to offer in terms of global order. So actions for me, actions and statements have real consequences. And if I try to specify it a bit, I mean, if you think about what's happening to the WTO under the Trump administration with the refusal to reappoint the appellate judges, if you think about the damage to climate change agreements, that his particular stance has taken, has provided. If you think about the concept of multilateralism, the UN system and the like, then all of these things have suffered a degree of challenge under the Trump presidency. which comes at a time when we live in a world, as Nena said, where with greater diffusion of power, there's a greater diffusion of values and interests that are being expressed and want to be satisfied, in a sense. So the provider of order, or the contributor, the major contributor to order, is in a sense responsible for taking away some of those elements that help to bind us together as some kind of global whole. And I suppose my sense is that we may end up with kind of a regional spheres of influence type policy with a minimum level of coexistence in global politics if the kinds of ideas that Trump has put forward continue through to future US administrations.
Well, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. I hope you agree that's been a really interesting conversation. There were some notes of optimism in there. I'm still coming to terms with the fact that Pyongyang is so far away from Sydney, so thank you, Mena. And I also liked Hugh's injunction in a very British way that in relation to foreign influence operations, we should keep calm and carry on. So thank you, Hugh. But it's not over. Let me invite you all to take a break for 5 or 10 minutes, stretch your legs, and then I won't be on the panel, but my colleague's work will continue under the chairmanship of Sir John Holmes. Let me introduce John. Let me just tell you that John is one of the best diplomats that the FCO has produced. He served his country in Moscow, Paris, New Delhi and Lisbon. He was diplomatic advisor to both Prime Ministers Major and Blair, which is quite a quinella. And he also served at the UN as Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator before taking over his post at Ditchley. So for the moment, take a break and come back to this panel. But in the meantime, give them a quick round of applause because they did a great job. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining in this second half of the discussion. And the discussion now is for you, as they say on the best TV panel programs. Over to you. What I noticed from the first session is what I've noticed from the first three examples of this dialogue of the last 3 years is that whatever the intentions are at the beginning, we always get sucked back to China. It just sucks all the air out of the rest of the discussions. Well, let's try and avoid that if we can, but I won't be surprised if we don't entirely succeed. Can I ask you, when you ask your questions, just to say who you are so we know who you are asking the question? You're allowed to make a comment as well as a question, but can you just keep them brief so we can give everybody, as many people as possible, a chance to ask a question? If you want to ask a question of a particular panelist, do so. Otherwise, we'll turn it over to the panel. But as I said to them beforehand, not every member of the panel needs to respond to every question. Otherwise, we won't get beyond two or three. I'll take the questions individually to start with, but we may have to go to groups depending on how much enthusiasm there is around the room. So who would like to start with the first question?
My name is Ashley Brosnan. I'm responding to what Hugh White said, but I think anyone in the panel can answer. Hugh, you were sort of saying that we should keep calm and not worry. And sort of say, you know, many states have been in history of being able to operate quite fine with a great power near them. But I think history shows that states act very neurotically in the face of stress. And I wondered what architecture or institution exists to actually deal with, you know, any sort of neuroticism or misjudgments that come from potential conflict points we see in the region.
You want to start?
I'm happy to start, but I think by far and away the best architecture for Australia would be the one we've had for so long, that is the one in which the United States is the uncontested primary power. But I no longer think it's credible for Australia to expect that as a possibility, and I think it's a waste of time, therefore, pursuing it. The second best outcome would be one in which the United States continues to play a significant role in Asia, not as the dominant power, but as one of a number of significant powers, along with not just China, but also Japan, and arguably in some circumstances India, in which they all sort of balance one another and constrain one another's power. This is a very familiar model of international, as an international system. It's essentially the concert model. It's not the same as a balance of power because there has to be a degree of agreement amongst, it's not a spontaneous thing, it has to be confected socially. And for a long time, I have been arguing that Australia's principal objective should be to try and build that, to encourage the United States to take part in a shared power-sharing construct like that. But that is not an easy gig, and in fact, to sustain that kind of position, the United States would be have to be willing to play a very substantial role. And I no longer believe that it's not impossible, but it now seems to be very unlikely that the United States is going to be able to play that role. I'm prepared to admit that I myself underestimated how badly the United States was going to perform, and not just under Trump. I also think the pivot was a notable policy failure. And to be honest, how good the Chinese turned out to be, how artful they've been, not just in growing their power, which they've done better than many people expected, but how artfully they've used it. They're good at this stuff. And so I therefore think we're now in a position where, although, as Rosemary said, there are lots of different options and lots of different players, I think the chances of effective cooperation between the other powers in Asia to constrain China from achieving a significant level of primacy or a version of primacy are pretty low. And so the best thing we can do is to try and build connections with other countries to help us manage that. And our instinct is to try and institutionalize that, to get a formalized grouping. I don't think that's going to work. I think what we're going to end up doing is building a whole lot of ad hoc bilateral connections with different countries, because our interests won't tend to coincide uniformly across a wide range of issues. But on this issue, we won't be able to cooperate with those guys. And on that issue, we might be able to cooperate with those guys. Every so often, we'll have to swap sides. This will be a much more fluid kind of diplomacy than Australia has been used to. It'll be quite an exciting time for those in the diplomatic business. I think it'll be quite engaging. But there's not, if you like, an institutionalized model for how we deal with this. It's going to be piece by piece.
Minna.
Can I just make a brief comment about neuroticism, I think? And in the UK, we'd probably say keep calm and drink tea rather than keep calm and carry on. But I think, you know, I don't think there is any need for neuroticism on the part of Australia. And in my career, you know, I lived in Israel for 4 years, which has got every reason actually to feel highly neurotic and arguably sometimes does, but is nonetheless a very successful economy and society. And I think some of this is about some of the issues that the rest of the world has been facing for a long time, just feeling a little bit closer. And the sort of tools and the techniques and the systems that we've all developed to deal with some of those threats, I think, you know, Australia is including through its white paper, also sort of accessing those same sorts of sets of ideas and values. But, you know, let's remember Australia is a very big country. It's a long way from most other places. It's 31 and a half times the size of the UK. It's had 27 years of uninterrupted economic growth. Yes, there are issues and challenges, but I don't think there's any need personally for Australia to feel neurotic or indeed, as Hugh has said, to panic.
Yes, just very quickly, Rosemary.
Very quickly. I mean, I suppose I would slightly differ from Hugh in that I think there's sort of a longer time lag for the decline of the US architecture. I think the sticking power of these alliance relationships and institutional networks that exist in the region are perhaps, you know, give us a little bit more time than you would suggest. And I think in that time, I'm not trying to pretend that this political and economic and military transition isn't an extraordinarily difficult period and fraught with danger and the like. But in this period, what can we do practically? We have to think about the usual things, building capacities of local states, trying to reinforce networks among them, thinking about what institutional structures we do have, East Asia Summit and APEC and the like, thinking about ASEAN Defence Minister Meeting Plus and so on, which is the ASEAN 10 plus six others, is that right? And, you know, what they can do in terms of codes for unplanned encounters at sea, extending that to the air and the like, trying in our usual way, in the usual way in which great powers try to manage their relations, trying to find areas where confidence can be built, where there will be forms of cooperation that will be beneficial. Nobody can pretend that this is easy or not dangerous, but we have to look at what we've done over the decades in some ways. We have to, in some sense, think about how the United States and the Soviet Union managed that tense relationship and try to find some of the avenues that were there.
Right, still stuck on China. I'll come back to you in a minute. Yes, at the back there. Yeah.
My name is Vijay. My question is based on that Gramscian idea of power operating at two levels. material terms of domination, but also in terms of moral and intellectual leadership. So in this Monroe-style system of China where everything is economic leverage, do you think it's relevant whether or not China can consolidate a normative leadership to influence policy autonomy? Yeah.
Okay, who would like to tackle that first? Chinese soft power.
I would mind tackling it. Yes. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. To be recognized as a hegemon, you need both material power and the consent of others. In other words, you have to fulfill a leadership function whereby others actually support the goals that you advance and the like. And in the latter part of the US involvement in the Asia Pacific, it enjoyed that hegemony, a degree of consent and support from others. But don't forget the era of the Vietnam War and prior to that, the Korean War. Then that was much more a materially coercive period in American Asia Pacific policy. They managed to move into, as I say, an area of US hegemony. Can China do the same? I think it's actually going to be extraordinarily difficult. I think that there are few signs that it has, as I've said in the first half, that it has the capacity to bring others along through a consent model, if you like. I mean, if I take one example, regional comprehensive economic partnership, which is supposed to be an economic integration model where China has more enthusiasm when it thinks about that particular economic structure, but is unable to bring it to a satisfactory conclusion. So there are signs, in a sense, that this material domination is going to be through more of a coercive mechanism than a consent mechanism, and therefore will not deserve the term Chinese hegemony.
Okay. Anybody else want to add anything?
I just had a thought, and that is just to say that I'm not sure that to establish leadership you have to get people to support what you want to do. You have to get them to understand that the costs of opposing you are higher than you're willing to bear. You don't have to love it. You just have to not hate it enough to be prepared to take it on. And I think my expectation, I wouldn't put it stronger than that, that China will end up in a position of very significant primacy in the region, not absolute hegemony, perhaps, but very significant primacy, is based on the idea that it has a high chance of having sufficient power to impose sufficient costs on the rest of us for us to grudgingly decide to go along with what it's got in mind, rather than to welcome it with open arms. You see, there is a kind of a trade-off. The more people like you, the less power you need to establish your authority. But if you've got lots and lots of power, and therefore you can impose lots of costs on people, then people appear to say, don't like this much, but I'll go along with it. And if you actually ask, what does Asia feel like today? I was in Jakarta last week. Nobody wants to live under China's shadow, but they don't dislike it enough to be willing to pay the cost of opposing it. And I think that's actually true of Australia as well.
A bit of a paradox there somewhere, though, that China is the country which has done best out of the international rules, than any other country. And yet, so what does it want to change exactly is never as clear as it might be.
Well, actually, I think it's actually very clear. It's like it's on a bus, and it likes the journey that the bus is going on. Why wouldn't it? Look at what it's done for it. It doesn't want to change. It doesn't want to change the bus. It doesn't even want to change the journey. It just wants to be in the driving seat. Because once it's in the driving seat, we don't know where it's going to take us. But it just wants to be in charge. And that's not unknown in the history of other countries either.
Okay, the lady here.
My name is Georgia Sianovich, member of the public. I wonder whether you would agree that One Belt, One Road initiative and the String of Pearls strategy and the AIDB are perhaps China's way of establishing that hegemony through economic means and geographic location throughout, not just in Asia, but really globally.
Interesting that nobody's mentioned those so far, right? Who'd like to have a go at that one?
I think that's right. If they are successful, they are put forward as global and regional public goods, where China is offering something that's not simply in its own interest, but in the interests of others. The problem is on the Belt and Road Initiative, is actually rolling out this program in such a way that you are going to get successful outcomes either for the countries that are enveloped within the Belt and Road Initiative or in terms of China's own financial interests, commercial interests, and the like. So it looks like a brilliant, you know, hegemonic strategy in some ways, but the unfolding of it is very, very, very difficult, I think. On the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, one of the crucial elements of that, in some ways, is to dilute the notion that this is a Chinese infrastructure bank run by China, with China taking the decisions. China's contribution, obviously capital contribution, has been diluted, and the impact of that on its voting share has been diluted by the fact that there are now a large number of members, and possibly even Japan will join at some part in the future. The other thing about the AIIB in terms of design is that it doesn't look unlike the other multilateral institutions that we have in train. So, yes, it's a very interesting, innovative development to focus on infrastructure, and has the capacity for bringing positive outcomes in a number of states. But it's almost China as being part of the world rather than China as, you know, challenging the world in that sense.
Can I just have one comment, perhaps? Which again is just based on my own sort of experience, I suppose, in Africa. I spent 6 years in Africa in my career, and in more recent terms, I've definitely seen a lot more Chinese money coming in on big development projects. And I think, sort of relating that to your question, I think we just have to be really clear-eyed, but also quite pragmatic. And we certainly shouldn't assume that just because it's coming from China, it's necessarily bad. And it can be in the interest of those countries. And frankly, there's lots of space in the world for countries reaching into new areas in order to promote greater development. So, you know, the sort of the plus side of that story is that I believe China's just invested in a new rail line from Nairobi to Mombasa, which is just so needed for that country. I think we built the first one about 100 years ago, and it's not doing too well. So, you know, we shouldn't necessarily assume it's all bad. On the other hand, when I was in Ghana and I saw the way some of those projects were being done, I had a nasty incident in the north of Ghana where a football stadium was being built by Chinese money with Chinese contractors, and the local population were having a bit of a riot about it because there was nothing in it for them, and the poverty around was still incredibly visible. So I think, you know, we have to look at what's happening, be pragmatic, clear-eyed, judge each thing on its merits, engage where we think it's in our interests or other countries' interests to do so. But if we think there's, you know, other stuff going on in terms of domination for domination's sake, or things being done not in the interests of the local population, then we should speak out. And I think you've seen that threaded through British policy on, for example, the AIIB as well as OBOR.
We obviously need to understand a lot of what is behind Chinese policy and what is in Chinese policy. And Belt and Road's a very broad thing. And much of the discussion, it seems to me, isn't very well informed. I mean, it's an all-encompassing thing that, if you believe the Chinese media, includes not only infrastructure development in Pakistan, but the space program that China conducts in Western China and a whole lot of other things. The key is, as the High Commissioner here has said, is to think about when Australia is involved at the governmental level, the principles that we think are important when you're talking about infrastructure financing and investment. And the AIIB has, from its early conception, and I was in Beijing when it was first announced in Jakarta by President Xi, and then slowly built up and had more members possibly than the Chinese anticipated in the beginning, is essentially based on some clear principles around transparency and the way projects are financed. And that makes sense for the Australian government to be involved in, and like the UK government and many others, we're a very constructive player in that organisation. More broadly, in other areas, and there's a vast sweep of possible projects that could be given the label of BRI, it's really a commercial decision for commercial players to work out. And our interest is in being clear about what principles there are. You know, is it open tendering? If it is, terrific. Our companies will be there, and there'll be lots of opportunity because foreign investment makes the world work, and China has a lot of capital. And the fact that it's flowing out does present a vast opportunity, but it's not as simple as, 100% support or 0% support. It's, you have to work out which part of the initiative, which specific project you're interested in.
Yeah, thanks. Chris Hughes, London School of Economics. I sort of want to jump back a couple of questions before, because, talking about Chinese power, and Hugh mentioned a really great example, which is close to my heart as an academic, of course, of the 160,000, I think it was, Chinese students. It kind of makes us realize it's not about abstract international relations theory. It's really everyday life now we're talking about. But yeah, that's right. And taxes and so on. So it's a real issue. But I think maybe you're the one who's panicking a bit, because the other option is these things cost things. They cost China, If they're not going to send their students to Australia, they're sending them here because they're getting an education. So if they say, okay, we don't like what you teach about Tibet, take them away. So where are they going to go? US? UK? Now, what if the US and UK also say we're going to teach about Tibet? Then they can't send their students anywhere. So then, but that depends on coordination between academics, universities, and governments, which we don't see at the moment. So it's easy to divide and rule. But I think there is another way forward on that, and that probably applies to other sectors too.
Look, I think that's a really good point. In fact, I don't. I'm not sure the problem is as big as some of us have made it out here. I mean, I do think of course, think academic freedom is terribly important. I don't have as strong a sense as some others do that the Chinese are really putting a full court press on this issue. But it is a good dramatic way of demonstrating the kind of choices and costs we're going to have to face. In the, there's a separate point, of course, and that is that for Australia, particularly, I think, as a country that depends so heavily on the Chinese market for the functioning of our tertiary sector, it's a declining market for us in the long term because China's own tertiary sector is developing so swiftly. We are the beneficiary of the fact that China has waited to this point to get into mass tertiary education, but one of the characteristics of the Chinese approach to economic development is they've got into mass tertiary education at a much earlier stage of their industrial revolution than Britain or America or Australia did. And in the not too distant future, they will indeed anyway have the chance to educate. Their choice will not be to send their students to Britain or America, but just to send them to educate them at home in China. And one of the risks for us is even if we do cooperate, we'll just hasten that process. Either way, Australia has to think of a different way of, tertiary education is not going to be our third biggest export after iron ore and coal for very much longer.
Look, I just want to make a point about education. I'm not necessarily as a counterpoint to Hugh's argument, but most of the education decisions made in Chinese society today are made by families, not by governments. And Australia... it's not the most important thing, it seems to me, for our higher education is to retain its quality and integrity. So customers, if you want to call them that, or families choose to send and entrust Australian institutions with their children's education. The China number is big, but it's only 26% of the total international student body. So people are making this choice from across the world. And I think, as you know, in Australia, we've been quite successful at blending travel for education with travel for tourism, with paths to residency, and a very successful skill migration program. And, it's not just about the education you get at ANU. I'm sure it's terrific, but it's also about Australia and what Australia offers. And, we can, I think, not be complacent about that, but pretty confident. And it's not like there's a committee saying, yes, okay, Australia can have 50,000 this year and UK 35,000 the next. These are families making these choices, and we are succeeding in a pretty competitive sector. And we need to sort of be confident about our ability to keep doing that. And I think, it's easy to play up the idea that that can somehow be taken away by government diktat. This is a market outcome.
Governments do have power, especially in China. It's the lady at the back.
Hi, Frances Kitt from the Lowy Institute. At the end of this year's Altman meeting, Julie Bishop spoke about a revitalised Commonwealth under British leadership. So I'm interested to know what this revitalisation really means for Australia, what it might look like, and how much of a role it will really play in upholding a rules-based order.
Meta, come on, this is your, this is your cue.
It's a Commonwealth question. I've been waiting for an opportunity to talk about this, so thank you very much. I mean, just a couple of very brief points, I think. Just about the Commonwealth itself, 52 countries around the world, representing 2.4 billion people, with a very large component, 60% of that under the age of 30. And within this region, the Asia-Pacific, there are 18 Commonwealth countries, including some very big players, including India, Malaysia, and others. So, you know, I think it's an extraordinary global network, and in the context of what we've been talking about, which is diffusion, fragmentation, the need to sort of reassess how we work across different international fora in order to achieve, defend, project, promote our values and our interests, I think it's of interest. I think we have had really good conversations with the Australians about the Commonwealth. And I think it's fair to say there is at times some scepticism as to its value and relevance. But certainly from the UK perspective, I think we think the time is right to really invest in it, invest energy and focus into it, and work with like-minded allies like Australia to think about what does that mean for its agenda. So we've got CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in April next year, straight after the Commonwealth Games in the Gold Coast. So I think next April will be a big sort of Commonwealth month. And we really want to look at how to use the Commonwealth to secure greater prosperity, security, sustainability, including in the small island states. The Pacific, I think, the link between Pacific countries and the Commonwealth, I think, is of interest to Australia. Julie Bishop talks a lot about, she went to the Caribbean a few months ago, and I think was really struck there by how small island states do see the importance of the Commonwealth to them, including pursuing objectives on, you know, fighting climate change, resilience, development, governance. So I think we can make common cause on all of that, and we're certainly working really closely with Australia in the run-up to CHOGM next year. In terms of the rules-based international system, why does all this matter? Because a lot of the long-term threats to our security come from things like climate change. They come from issues that we've been talking about a sort of loss of shared values and confidence, I think, in the importance of those. And I think those sort of perhaps less tangible things are really where the Commonwealth's strength lies, because it's a lot of it's about human links and about people and about networks and about values. So I think it does have a role to play, and we'll hopefully see more of that next year.
Justin. Well, I mean, we a member of many groups and the Commonwealth now for a long time, but of course the Australian government strongly supports the UK government in its chairing next year of CHOGM and in its sort of pretty determined and active agenda to revitalise the group and put it to good and productive use, and we're 100% behind that.
Okay, I mean, if I was taking over Michael Fuller's role of asking officials difficult questions, so to do what exactly?
Well, I mean, I think there's lots and lots of different areas that the Commonwealth is engaged in, and I've sort of set out the broad scope of that. I mean, if you're looking for specific examples, I think the sort of Commonwealth position in the run-up to the COP in Paris was a very useful way of consolidating 52 countries behind a consistent position. I think if you look at the governance agenda, particularly, as I said, in small island states, there's definitely a role. The Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, you know, holds fantastic workshops in this region and beyond on everything from, you know, better governments, women's empowerment, but also issues like countering extremism, which is obviously of concern in a very broad number of Commonwealth countries, including in this region. I think the issue has been sort of consistency, leadership, and sort of getting away from some of the summits which lots of heads of government, I think, like to talk about, which have just not been focused and clear enough. But I think we see a real opportunity next year to try and get it to a better place.
The best thing about that, nobody mentioned China for about 2 minutes.
Double
right,
win.
Who else? Gideon. Yeah.
Follow-up question to the Commonwealth question. It struck me thinking about the kind of intellectual origins of Brexit and why it happened, that a lot of the people who drove the process were people who were very interested in the idea of the Anglosphere writing about it back in the 1990s and saw that more as Britain's natural home. And now, I guess, with Liam Fox being here this week, you can see that idea, I don't think, is dead in the minds of the current government. And May went very quickly to Washington. I think Britain is looking now to Australia, the US, for hopefully for trade deals. I just wonder whether people think that idea, certainly possibly from an Australian perspective, have times moved on. Certainly reading the Australian white paper, Britain doesn't feature very much. It features, there's a mention of the Five Eyes, but other than that, Australia's focus is now Asia, the US, and so on. But to put a slightly, just to end on another thought, though, it strikes me that the Brexit vote may have suggested that, at least in the minds of the British electorate, they did feel more comfortable, not so much committed to Europe, but looking to the wider world, perhaps to the Anglosphere. And is that strain of thought anywhere present in Australia? I mean, you've had this debate in the past about, is Australia really an Asian nation? And as China rises, how do you think the Australian public are going to react to this idea of adapting to a more China-centric world?
Okay, who wants to have an Australian response to that, I think?
Well, I'll go first. It's a terrific question, Gideon. I mean, it's an old story in Britain, isn't it? I mean, you can sort of tell the history of British foreign policy, if you're presumptuous enough to do so as an Australian, between those who looked across the Channel and those who looked across the Atlantic and to the wider world, you know, Europe versus the Empire. You know, this classic Tory Whig conception of foreign policy. And you can tell the same story in Australia. There are two kinds of stories about the way Australia is seen as place in the world. As a country that's as irrevocably committed to an Asian destiny, and as a country that's irrevocably committed to a destiny of, with its great and powerful friends at the global level. And of course, what most resolutions of those in both countries have attempted to do is to say, oh, it can be both. And of course, as much as possible, you want to be both. But sometimes, to contradict the Australian government, you do have to make some choices. And one of the surprising things about Brexit is that the choice that Britain appeared to have made for Europe all those decades ago seemed to be one that a lot of Brits were prepared to turn their back on. And the logic, I absolutely agree, the logic of that is for Britain to look to, well, it's a global Britain, that's the phrase, and obviously that means America, it means rebuilding links with the old empire through the Commonwealth and so on. And so the really interesting question, does Australia have, could we change our mind too? I mean, for a long time you could say Australia's instinct has been to say, just as Britain said we're going for Europe, we've said we're going for Asia. But the Asia we see today is less congenial, more scary than the one we thought we had, because the one we thought we had was made safe for us by American power. And if it's not going to be made safe for us by American power, then maybe there is a scope for Australia to say, well, maybe we just don't like this Asia story. So at one level, people would say, but that's crazy. How could we possibly divorce ourselves from Asia? Well, that's what we used to say about the British in Europe as well. Transpired the voters, at least some of the voters, had a different view. And there is a strand in Australian thinking even now, I'm going to say more now than there would have been, say, in the 80s, 70s or 80s, that there might be an option. Tony Abbott, as leader of the opposition, goes to Washington and says that Australians don't really feel like America is a foreign country. I think it's a very strange thing for an Australian political leader to say. And it's very clear that successive Australian governments, not just the present one, have worked very hard, ably supported by very gifted representatives, have worked very hard to reinvigorate the British, the relationship with Britain. It's now common for Australian political leaders to describe Britain as an ally in a way that we stopped doing after the withdrawal east of Suez. So the sense of Britain as a strategic partner has risen in Australia quite sharply over the last decade or so, something like that. So I don't think it's impossible. I think there's a strand in Australian thinking. Now, whether we're about to have an Australian exit, whether confronted with Asia dominated by China or with China playing a very leading role, we decide we just want to go home to mother. I'm not so sure. It seems to me almost unthinkable. But then again, I'm one of those people who said, Brits would never vote for Brexit. They'd be crazy.
Right. Well, geography does have tend to play a role. I mean, Britain is still in Europe, Australia is still in Asia, and these are facts you can't change by political wishes at any particular time.
Yes, that's true. Yes. Yeah.
Can I just on one point, on Britain not being that apparent in the white paper? I knew I brought it with me for a reason, but it does say when they talk about global partnerships, I think one of the first countries you talk about actually is the UK as, quote, one of Australia's most important partners. So, and I'm actually quite interested in Hugh's perception that our sort of status as a close ally has risen in recent years. And you know, I personally dislike the phrase the Anglosphere, and I would never use it because I think it refers to a different era, a different time, a different set of values, actually. But I think what it is about is it's about shared values. It's about, you know, common institutions often around law and you know, the basis of our whole legal and legislative systems. But it's about values. And, you know, when you look at the values in this white paper, you could just cross out Australia and put Britain. I mean, they are so similar. And I think that really matters. And it matters because of trust. So the thing that really strikes me is when you ask Australians which country in the world do you trust the most, they will say Britain. And when you ask Brits who in the world do you trust the most, they will say Australia. So you're looking really surprised, but it's true. It's true. The Lowy Institute poll tells us so. Yeah, 90% of people polled said that they trust Britain to do good in the world. And when Chatham House did a survey about UK views of Australia, you had almost exactly the same result. So I think in the world that we're talking about, this stuff really matters. And I think that is the foundation of, you know, very, very close relations between Britain and Australia and other like-minded allies.
Yeah, but economics and prosperity also figures hugely in the paper, and that doesn't encompass very much in the way of Britain.
Except we have the second largest investor here.
But I think I want to quickly say something. The white paper obviously has a regional framing, and it says no higher priority for Australia than such and such in the Indo-Pacific. But it does frame Australia as having global interests and global partnerships. And when you look at the economics and you look at investment as much as trade, Britain is very crucial to our interests. When you look at a whole range of what academics and other experts call non-traditional security threats, counter-terrorism, foreign interference and so on, then our cooperation with Britain and the other Five Eyes is fundamentally important. So it's not sentiment. Its interests as well driving this partnership, but maybe Britain's not going to be intimately involved in responding to China's power or something in Southeast Asia. That's possible. But when we're thinking of counterterrorism, when we're thinking about global cooperation, when we're thinking about open global economies, the world trading system, capital flows in and out of our respective countries, Britain really is one of our most important partners if we define our interests widely rather than narrowly.
Thanks, Sir John. Hugh, I just wanted to come back to this question of costs, because I'm curious about something that you said earlier, that occasionally Australia would have to bear some of those costs. But obviously, in some situations, and the American alliance seems to be one of those for you, Australia should be willing to make sacrifices with its values or with its interests in order to not bear some costs. So I'm curious, what are those areas? And if I could just draw your attention to a specific example. It seems clear now that what has happened in Rakhine State over the last 3 months are at the very least crimes against humanity. And China has shielded Myanmar from international scrutiny in the Security Council and other places. Australia has also been a big supporter of ASEAN centrality that China has deeply opposed and feels threatened by. So are there places where you are not willing to wear the cost, where you actually think Australia should make compromises? And what are those areas? And how would Australia... How could Australia be sure that those compromises would be durable, that China would honor the implicit agreements in those compromises in the future?
Yeah, look, that's really a central question, Aaron. I mean, in a sense, my whole argument is that's the debate we're going to have to start to have. We're going to have to stop hoping that somehow those hard choices are going to be shielded from us by American power or the preservation of a rules-based order, that there'll be a rules-based order which will set rules within which China can't force those sorts of choices upon us. So I think, I mean, there's a lot of different dimensions to the different cases you've mentioned. I think Australia has a lot of choices. We can easily choose to oppose China on questions like what's happening in Myanmar at the moment. We could easily choose to oppose China. The question as to whether we can do anything effective about it ourselves. But I think, you know, I don't think Australia should be at all anxious about preserving that kind of freedom to maneuver. Apart from anything else, I don't think in the end China can impose very heavy costs on us.
But if, for example, we were to decide to change our mind about what's happening in Tibet, or to start changing our policy to managing relations with Taiwan, then the costs would go through the roof. And I just make the observation as a point of history, so to speak, that no Australian government has been prepared to wear those costs for a very long time. And I don't expect they will in the future. And I'm not saying that's necessarily good policy or bad policy. I'm just saying that's the choice we've made. And we're going to face more choices like that as China has more power to impose higher costs on us as its relative position in the region grows. But there's one point on which Australia has been very clear for a very long time, and that is that we are not willing to compromise our position as a US ally. John Howard sat down with Jiang Zemin at the end of 1996, which was a difficult year in Australia-China relations, and said, come what may, Australia is going to remain a US ally, and there's nothing you can do about that. But then he said, but nothing we do as a US ally will be directed against China. And Jiang Zemin said, thank you, Mr. Howe. That's just what I wanted to hear. And the real choice we've made is that nothing Australia has done since 1996 as a US ally has been seriously directed against China. Well, the Chinese looked those up and down and said, that doesn't really worry us. And you'll not notice that Australian government has never been prepared to describe that as directed at China. In fact, it's gone out on the record publicly saying, in relation, for example, to V1s operating through Darwin, the Australian alliance with America is not directed at anyone. But if you're in America, where the whole point of the pivot is to round up countries in Asia, including Australia, to support you in pushing back against China's challenge to US primacy, they do want you to say something different. That's what the pivot was all about. That's why Barack Obama made the speech in Canberra.
Yeah, but even the Americans tended to say it wasn't directed against China, even if it was obviously everybody that it was.
Which is part of the problem, isn't it?
Yes, right.
I mean, you know, that's why the pivot is so weak, that America itself is not really sure it wants to do that, which is one of the reasons why I don't think they're going to succeed.
Presley, obviously. Itching to say something different.
Well, yes, I am itching to say something different. I mean, I think the pivot was, you know, a multifaceted policy of some subtlety that included these deterrent elements within it, plus reassurance of allies, plus a search for areas of cooperation with China, because that was reflective of regional sentiment, you know, and this desire not to polarize the region between the US and China. So I think it was actually one of the most subtle policies that the United States has introduced in a number of years. It doesn't necessarily mean they were successful or the like. Yeah. And I think that the Chinese could indeed have taken the Darwin decision in a completely different way, in part because Obama did make that speech there and the tone of it and the like. And they could have chosen that moment to say, you know, this is equivalent to, you know, you're clearly lining up and you're clearly lining up. They saw the pivot as directed at them. They described it as a containment policy. Therefore, ipso facto, you were part of a containment policy. And they chose not to impose real costs on you. So let's think about, you know, when China is willing to impose costs and when it's willing to bear those costs.
We could have a long debate about that.
Let's just keep getting one or two more questions at the back there, yes.
James Curran from Sydney Uni. Hugh, you made the point earlier that the rules-based order is code for American primacy, which I think is absolutely right, the use of that phrase, is code for American primacy. My question is about the idea underpinning American primacy and the state of that idea at the moment. That is, the US's idea of a special mission, divine providence, the shining city on a hill. I guess it's a question for Justin as well. What happens when that idea starts to lose its virtue? And that's what I think we've seen not only under this administration but under two previous administrations. I mean, Bush more or less trashed that idea in Iraq. Obama questioned exceptionalism at the beginning of his administration, then spent the rest of his time in office trying to out-exceptionalize everybody else. And now Trump doesn't speak that language at all of the Pax Americana or this idea of America having this mission to redeem the world. So what happens? I mean, this is the basis of the White Paper's confidence on America anchoring itself in the region in terms of its regional and global leadership. But what about that idea? Because America has paid a very high price for its national ideals in the past, most notably in Vietnam and then Iraq.
But what happens when America is not as confident, when the public consensus for a more ambitious foreign policy is not there? And do you see that changing anytime soon? And most importantly, and I think, Hugh, you've dealt with this in the past, in another piece of writing, what does this mean for how the Americans understand China and China's rise as a threat to American exceptionalism? Mm.
Can I go ahead?
Look, I'm someone as distinguished as James and well-versed in American history. I'm not going to comment on all of that. But the white paper doesn't talk about primacy. It the concept of primacy, whatever it means, is not in the white paper. The frame of the white paper is the world and our region is getting more competitive and contested, and that the United States will be deeply involved in that competition and that contestation. And so the anchoring is not a view, an interpretation of the government about American psychology or public opinion. It's a judgment about American interests. So there are alliances, tens of thousands of troops, massive amounts of capital investment, huge amounts of trade, lots of Americans in the region, and the United States is the wealthiest country in the world. It's the global financial heart, and it's the main innovator in the global economy. Nobody in Asia wants anything other than strong US engagement. So we have made a judgment about the region, and the government has made a judgment about that region, and it's got the US in it. It's not saying there's going to be a transition from one type of hegemon to another. It's talking about a messy reality, and Australia actually being active in response to that with its partners. Now, we could debate for hours on all of this, but that's sort of my first response, that if you're test of the white paper is, does it talk about primacy or not? It's the wrong test. The white paper doesn't use that frame. It's trying to deal with a very messy reality that we face and making, you know, candid and clear-eyed judgments about a difficult period in the region and globally. But US power and influence in Asia is, in our view, deeply anchored in this region.
Yeah, but very quickly, because I want to just ask you one more. One more question before we finish.
Okay. Wise
caution.
And you've
said quite a lot on this subject already.
Wise caution. One of the key questions is, to what extent we're talking about, is American primacy good and is American primacy going to last? Even under Trump, even with all the wacky things that Bush did, I still prefer American primacy to any other kind that's on offer. I'll take America with all its faults. I just don't think it's going to be there. And that's the basic difference between my assessment and the assessment reflected in the white paper. America has immense interests in Asia, of course, but it's very unclear that those interests require it to preserve the kind of leadership role it has played. I'll avoid the word primacy. The kind of leadership role it has played. There's a complex argument in that. My recent quarterly essay addresses that argument. I think the evidence is very clear, particularly from Obama and Trump, that the United States is no longer willing. Voters are no longer willing to underwrite the vision of US global leadership with the costs which are entailed in resisting a power as powerful as China in Asia, or for that matter, Russia in Eastern Europe, be required to sustain that vision of US global leadership. And I therefore think it would be very unwise for Australia to base its policy on the assumption that it'll still be here, notwithstanding the significance of the interests.
I'll just finish up by abusing my privilege by asking everybody a different question. We hardly talked about Southeast Asia because we've been obsessed with China, as always. Yes. But I think we should a little bit. Yes. And the question I wanted to ask was whether, leaving aside the relative sort of balance of forces between the US and China and the traction that that, or the coercion factor that that exercises on Southeast Asian countries, are they retreating because of this narrative that Rosemary was referring to, whether of liberal democracy doesn't really work, it doesn't deliver? Whereas Chinese, whatever you want to call it, authoritarianism, you know, guided democracy, well, it's not that even, but anyway, whatever you want to call it, does deliver. Does that mean that democracy in some senses, or the value which is in retreat in a serious way in Southeast Asia?
If I may Rosemary, quickly go first. Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of those questions, you know, don't overdo it, don't panic in a sense, because of course there are concerns that we all have about the state of the transition, the political transition in Myanmar. We're extraordinarily concerned about the Philippines. We're very concerned about Cambodia. We're very concerned about Thailand and military rule, but the region is quite a lot, yes, but on the other hand, we've been through many decades when this sort of anchoring of our version of liberal democracy has not been that powerfully held in the region. We have a number of what we describe as semi-authoritarian states in Southeast Asia. Indonesia, obviously, that important transition from the Suharto era, incredibly important, but in retreat of concern in those four countries that I've mentioned, but on the other hand, don't let's assume that it was a sort of a vision of a liberal democratic space in the first place.
The trend was good for a while, and now it looks less good.
Yes, it looks less good.
Yeah. I think I just completely agree with Rosemary, really. And again, I think here, you know, the longer-term view is also helpful. The region hasn't always been the most peaceful and democratic in the world. And, you know, I'm an eternal optimist. So I tend to believe that in general, the direction of the world, including Southeast Asia, is a good one. But it needs constant vigilance. And there's something about it at the moment which I think is unpredictable and does cause a certain amount of anxiety for all of us. But you know, as you said, Indonesia, South Korea, India, one of the world's greatest democracies and huge population, the progress you know Japan has made since the end of the Second World War, and then you know bastions of stability and democracy for all its faults in Australia and New Zealand, and the current volatility here you know might well be just a short blip in a story of great sort of economic success and stability. So you know I think that's why we need the sort of things we've been talking about today, the FPDA, Shangri-La dialogue we haven't talked about. That's an annual meeting of defence ministers which gets together and looks at some of the challenges in the region, the Commonwealth on the value side, all the, you know, the groupings, ASEAN, and all the different iterations of that. So, you know, I think we've got the right mechanisms in place to deal with it. And I think let's just keep, this sounds a bit sort of Pollyanna-ish, but maintaining a sense of perspective and optimism and working together to sustain the better things about what's happening in this region.
Predictably enough, I'm marginally more gloomy than you.
really?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's not all as bad as it could be, but I think John's point is absolutely right. For a long time, it was easy to conclude that the overall trend was positive, and it's much harder to conclude that now. And I would just put a little bit more weight on Indonesia. Of course, at one level, Indonesia is a great success story. You know, you told us 20 years ago, in fact, that Indonesia was going to go through the kind of democratic transition it did go through. We'd have said, no, we're not going to be that lucky. But we were. But the story's not over yet. And Indonesia is extraordinarily important to us. All of Southeast Asia, but Indonesia is particularly. And I think it needs to loom much larger in our foreign policy debates than it does at the moment. And it's hard to get a word in edgeways because of China. But remember, it will be the world's fourth biggest economy before the middle of the century on present trends. And that's going to be a radical shift for Australia. We'll have a great power next door, and we've never had that before. The other point is that I think this has to not just affect our optimism about what happens in those countries internally, but about how the region works more broadly. And although I don't tend to see what's happening with China as a kind of a classic Cold War-style ideological contest, although some things coming out of Beijing, including recently, suggest a little bit of a flavour of that, but we'd be very complacent to assume that our model is so appealing to them and that they don't see that the Chinese model might have something to offer, particularly for leadership elites, because it does have something to offer for leadership elites, like an appearance of stability and security. I don't think we should be too optimistic about the idea that all of the countries in Southeast Asia are automatically going to line up on our side against the other side.
Justin, you know the last word.
Look, I've worked in and worked on Southeast Asia for a long time, and these are complex societies. And I think generally speaking, in those societies, people are after more opportunity and more say in the way they are governed. And if you take snapshots at different five-year periods, you know, the trend might go up and down. But overall, you know, people are interested in better governance, and they're not choosing one model or the other. These are complex countries with complex post-colonial histories. They're working out their own way of doing things. And sometimes an election will change the particular tenor or flavor of a country. The Philippines is one example. You have one sort of president now. You had a completely different one before. In 5 years' time, there'll be another election. Is that democracy imperfect in its institutions? Yes, it is. I think many Filipinos would admit that. But it's not turning into an authoritarian one-party state. And that trend is mixed across the region. But overall, I think we would be mistaken to assume that Southeast Asia is somehow turning its back on democracy. I don't think it is. Or market economies. Those societies are interested in being open to the world, and that's what they largely are. And for us, I agree with you on this point, they're going to loom large in terms of importance in Australian foreign policy.
Thank you very much. Well, let me finish on a relative note of optimism after a certain amount of gloom around the place. Thank you very much to the panel. Thank you to all of you for coming and for listening and being so patient. And let's give the panel a round of applause.